Hello, this is John Jantz with Duct Tape Marketing, and you've joined me for another Coaching Excellence series call. My guest today is Alan Weiss, and he has generated a ton of interest from folks, so I really appreciate the audience that's come on board here. I do want to remind you that this is brought to you by the Duct Tape Marketing Coach Network, which you can find at ducttapemarketingcoach.com. You can find a coach, find out about coaching itself. Throughout this presentation, we will be taking some questions and answering some questions, hopefully. And so you will see on the panel your tab that says questions and answers. You can hit those and submit them during the call at any time, and we will probably wrap up with answering a few of those questions. Also, during this call, I'm going to do what I have started doing the last few sessions. I'm going to pose some questions to the audience as a poll and hopefully get some feedback from you all. So it's a great way to see what's on people's minds when they're on these calls and to get a little feedback for our guest. And speaking of our guest, I want to bring him in. It is Alan Weiss, and he is a consultant, speaker, author, and CEO of Summit Consulting Group. He is a 2006 inductee into the Professional Speaking Hall of Fame and a recipient of the National Speakers Association Council of Peers Awards of Excellence, which really represents the top 1% of the professional speakers in the world. His publishing includes 25 books, including his bestseller, Million Dollar Consulting, and his newest Million Dollar Consulting Toolkit. So, Alan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, John.
So, one of the first things I want to talk about is the idea between coaching and consulting. That those two terms get bantered around a lot. I know you talk about them a lot, and there are some, I believe, some distinct differences between what they are and who they are and who should do them. And one of the things I want to do is, before I get, I want to directly ask you to address that, but before I do that, I'm going to open a little polling question here and see if we can figure out, I want to see how people sort of self-identify themselves that are on this call. So I'm going to ask a question here, and it basically is asking you, those folks that are on here, you can respond. It's basically asking you to decide. I consider myself a coach, a consultant, both, or neither. So we'll let this run for 10, 15 seconds here. I see people are coming in, and this is interesting, maybe. And I'll share those results with you, Alan, and then maybe we'll jump into, again, as I said, you know, maybe what some of those differences are. So I'm going to give about five more seconds for folks on the line to vote. And looks like we're getting pretty close to 80-90% participation on the vote. And I'm going to close the poll now in 3, 2, and 1. So I'm going to show you the results, and I don't know if this is a surprise or not, but Alan, it came in at 9% of our audience says they're a coach, 31% says they're a consultant, 36% says they're both, and 24% say neither. So with that new data in mind in that scientific survey, I'd love to hear your thoughts on really the differences between those two, because obviously people on this call are saying they are one or the other, and many people are saying they're both.
Well, let me begin by irritating as many people as I can.
I expect nothing other.
For the 24% who I guess are, you know, auto mechanics or airline pilots or something, everybody else is both. I don't care what they put in the poll. And the fact is that most of us who have been consulting for quite a while also had a coach as we did that. As we found things out, we had to coach our executive clients and our buyers on how to change their behavior and what to do to fix things or what to do to improve things. Coaching is a normal subset of consulting, as is facilitating, for example. What's happened over the past 10 years is that coaching has been artificially segregated by people who want to make extra money at it by running universities and all kinds of nutty things where they give you certificates that are authorized and certified by no one but themselves. You know, I always ask who certifies the certifiers. And so suddenly people became coaches, and coaching had cachet. You were a life coach, and executives liked having a coach by their side. But the fact is, except for coaching in the therapeutic sense, except for people who do marriage counseling and that kind of coaching, if you want to call that coaching, who are usually PhDs or at least have masters in psychology, except for that, in the business sense, if you're not a consultant and understand organizational dynamics and organizational realities, you're not going to be a very effective individual coach. And these coaches who come in just to advise a given manager in a given thing really don't have sufficient breadth or depth to do a great job. And so I would contend that people who are really excellent coaches are actually also consultants, and that people who are consultants had better be good coaches. So I don't like the artificial discrimination, and I think it's kind of silly to market yourself that way.
So what you're suggesting is that if you're in this role where you're going into businesses and trying to help them achieve some sort of result, or with individuals, you are a consultant.
Yes, because what you're doing is improving the client condition. Now, you might be improving the client condition by working with one person or seven people or the entire organization. But the key is, after we walk away, the client had better be improved. That is a consulting intervention. If you want to call yourself a coach or a trust advisor or a facilitator or an S3-5 inverted paradigm, I don't care. But why do we make things so complex?
Well, would it be safe to say then, if you were saying these are subsets, would it be safe to say that there are consultants, if we're going to agree with that, that some are good trainers, some are good speakers, some are good coaches, some are good facilitators, and that there may be a reason to go to where some of your strength is, or are you saying that you really need strengths in all of those?
I'm saying that you better be confident in all those things. Now, you might be better at some than others. For example, I happen to be a professional speaker, as you pointed out at the top, but that doesn't mean a consultant also needs to be a professional speaker. However, any good consultant had better be able to address a management reading and provide the results of a report or a survey or his or her findings with confidence and with a certain compelling interest, or they're not going to be very good. So what I'm saying is, in all of those subsets, you better at least be competent. You don't have to be an all-star, but you better at least be good.
So let's move on a little bit to results. I mean, that's what hopefully all of our clients, all of our customers are after. And I know you do a lot of work and even have some specific methodologies for some of the best ways to get results with customers. You want to share some of the strategies and tactics that you find to be the most useful?
Well, first, philosophically, you have to recognize that nothing matters except output.
Right.
Output doesn't matter. And consultants are overwhelmingly concerned with deliverables, which is just silly, because they're often dealing with silly people. They're dealing with human resource people and trainers. You should never deal with these people. They're not buyers. They don't really count. And so you need to deal with business executives, with line heads, with P&L heads, and so forth. And what you look for is the output. How is the client improved? And so there are three simple ways to do that. One, what are the objectives, which are always business outcomes, to be derived? In other words, a strategy retreat is a deliverable. But a strategy that helps you penetrate a new market is an outcome. Second, what are the metrics or measures of success that tell you you're making progress toward the objective? That way you and the client can agree playing a valuable role. And that leads me to the third one, which is value. If the client achieves those objectives with your help, what's the value to the organization? It's based upon that value that you can assign your fees. And as you know, I've written several books on value-based pricing. Anybody who's charging by the hour or day or any time unit is an amateur. And so that's why results are so important. Consultants should be concerned with how the client's condition is improved, not what they do to the client.
Yeah, you know, that's really, I mean, we could talk about just a couple things you said there for the rest of our time together. But, you know, I often find that a lot of consultants don't really want metrics, and because I think maybe there's some fear that they don't really put much value out. But I would suggest that you probably shouldn't go into an engagement that didn't have metrics and didn't have a way to measure, or you're probably going to short yourself.
Well, let me suggest how silly it is. If you take a look at Training Magazine, which is aimed at trainers, and that's the reason I read, you know, a broad section of the press.
Sure.
They advocate in there, different columnists and so forth, that you really shouldn't even try to evaluate training. And that's because all these vendors are selling boxes of material to HR people who aren't concerned about results. They're just concerned about putting people through classes and opening boxes and giving them books or software. Last year in the United States, according to the ASTD, something north of $65 billion was spent on training and development just in corporate America, and less than 10% of it, as far as I've been able to see, is ever attempted to be measured. And so you have this huge amount of input, and forget about salaries and people's time, this huge stuff going on with no discernible improvement in the organization. So if a consultant wants to stand stand out in a crowd. Focus on the result and how you measure the result, and then you don't have to charge by the box or the head of the day. You can charge based on the value you provide.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue to, actually I'm going to come back to the fees, but that's a perfect segue to our next area that I want to go into a little bit, and that's the idea. You know, a lot of times people call themselves a coach, they call themselves a consultant, whatever it is they're calling themselves. You know, one's like another in the market's mind sometimes. And so it's obviously, from a marketing standpoint, very important to create some sort of unique positioning, branding. I want to ask the audience, before I ask you to address that, a little bit about how their feelings on the fact, do they have any differentiation? So my question to the audience in this poll that I've just opened is, I have and communicate a unique point of differentiation, and I'd like you to tell me whether or not you think that is absolutely true, you're not sure, not really, sometimes, or I don't know what my unique position is. So again, we'll leave this open for about 30-40 seconds and get a little bit of sense of how the audience feels about positioning and branding, and then I'd love for you to maybe offer some advice or debunk that that comment completely, whichever seems appropriate. So we're going to leave it open about 6-7 more seconds. And I'm going to close the poll in 3, 2, 1. So our results, Alan, were that 43% of the people say they absolutely have and communicate a unique point of differentiation. 8% say they're not sure if they do. 10% say they don't really do it. And 34% say sometimes they do. Only 5% admit that they don't really know what their difference is. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that idea of a unique positioning and branding for a consultant.
Well, let me say three things about branding. The first is, you know, what are we talking about? We're talking about a uniform and consistent expression of value. I mean, that's what a brand is. But no matter where you are in the world, if you see Coca-Cola, you know what it represents. So it's a unique and consistent expression of value. The second thing is, there's a fallacy that it has to be unique. It can't be unique. I mean, unique means singular. But what a brand has to do is to help you to stand out in the crowd.
Right.
The third thing is that the ultimate brand is your name. And so I've used brands like The Contrarian. You know, one of my blog is called ContrarianConsulting.com.
Right.
I've used brands like Balancing Act. I've used brands like Ferrari. I've used all kinds of brands. But the ultimate brand is my name. Because if somebody says, get me a great strategic consultant, and my name is in the hat, that's good. But I'd rather have them say, get me Alan Weiss.
Mm-hmm.
So brands are extremely important. And you brand yourself by making sure you consistently and repetitively get that brand in front of people. So if your brand is your name and your name is Mary Jones, you don't put out 10 tips on leadership. You put out Mary Jones 10 tips on leadership. You don't put out a newsletter that says conflict resolution newsletter. You put out Mary Jones conflict resolution newsletter. And so branding is extraordinarily important because in consulting, you want people to come to you. The difference between you knocking on a door and saying, please use me, and someone coming to you and saying, I understand you're good, how can we work together, is humongous. And because in the first case, you have to prove that you're good, and people will always haggle about price. In the second case, people know that you're good, they want you, there's no cost of acquisition, and fee is academic. They'll pay whatever it is you want them to pay you. And so I call this marketing gravity. And the way you attain marketing gravity, where clients come to you, is through powerful branding.
So let me give you just a little challenge on one aspect of what you're saying there, because I agree with 99% of it. But what about the person that's out there saying, well, gosh, I'm building an organization, I'm building an asset, a brand that I actually want to sell. I want to take myself, you know, the person out of. I may build it, I may perfect it, I may be the thing that drives it, but you know, how do I build a brand that I maybe want to sell? If it's just me, you know.
Well, that's legitimate, but let me make this differentiation. There are only two business models in consulting, and I make no value judgments. They're both good. My business model is I work alone. Everything I make is profit, and every year I take everything I can out of the business because that's the kind of lifestyle I want to lead. I don't intend to leave Summit Consulting Group, which is my company, to my kids or to anybody else. It's just a legal framework, and Summit Consulting Group is not a brand.
Right.
Now, the second business model, and some of my friends have this, is a business model where your company is the brand, Acme Consulting, and you're building up infrastructure, staff, goodwill, clients, assets, and so on, with the intent of selling it someday for the equity. Now, that means that you can't take the money out every year. You have to constantly reinvest in the business. You have to be willing to manage employees, and you have to be willing to build that kind of infrastructure and hope that you can sell it for a huge profit at some indeterminate point in the future. Those are two different business models. So you're right. In that case, you would brand the company. But I'll tell you something. I've been in this business on my own since 1985. I have consulted with the Big Four. I've consulted with boutique firms. I've had over 700 people, individual practitioners in my mentor program. And so I have a pretty good frame of reference. And I will tell you, you know, unequivocally, that the real way to make money and gain wealth in this business is not by building infrastructure. Because you can get lucky and sell your firm for $10 million, but the odds are against you. It's very, very difficult.
And it's a lot more work.
It's a huge amount of work. Yeah. Plus, you know, if you give yourself a certain retirement plan, you have to provide it to every full-time employee.
Yeah.
You have the risk of people stealing clients and intellectual property. I mean, it's a real, real tough way to do it. Now, I've known some people who've done it successfully, but if you really want to get wealthy in this business, individual solo practice is the way to go.
Yeah. I want to finish up with our last polling question, and it surrounds around the idea of fees. Certainly a lot of professional folks I work with have some real issues with charging probably what they're worth or asking what something is worth in terms of results, because I think we've all been sort of hammered over the head with this hourly thing, not just the consultants, but our customers. And so I'm glad you already let that one out of the bag, that it's not about hourly fees. And so I'd love to, I'm going to ask this question that I've opened here. It says, I believe I charge what I'm worth. And the answers are, I'm charging too little. I'm charging the perfect amount. I want to charge more. I can't charge more. I get nervous asking for more. And I don't think you're going to be surprised by these, because I know you, lots of folks that come into your mentoring programs, I would suggest probably this is an issue, isn't it?
Well, less than 5% of consultants I've met are charging appropriately.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know how honest your respondents are going to be, but I'll tell you right now, I don't think their demographic would be any different.
Well, I'm going to leave this open for about 5 more seconds here. And I think that my audience is somewhat truthful, judging on what I'm seeing. So the results are that 23 admit to charging too little. Only 11% feel like they're charging perfect amount. 48%, I want to charge more. 19%, I get nervous asking for more. So I'll just toss that one up and let you hit it out of the park. How's that?
Well, you know, those 11% really scare me, because how do they know it's the perfect amount?
That's right.
But they know they shouldn't be charging more. I mean, look, what I found here, I'm running a seminar in December called the Self-Esteem Workshop. You know, I used to think when I first started helping consultants that their basic problem was they were undercapitalized and didn't have enough money to see them through tough times. I was completely wrong, utterly completely wrong. The basic problem with consultants is lack of self-esteem, and they have a tough time in a large office or with a powerful figure telling them that the fee is $75,000 or $112,000 or $250,000. And that it's a real self-esteem issue. If you believe for a moment that your value and what you provide, your intellectual property, your smarts, can help clients vastly improve their business, and that improvement is annualized, because once they have it, they apply it year after year, I can get anybody who's charging by the time units out of their mind. Like I said, they're an amateur. But the pressure on fees has to be constantly upwards. In fact, bias psychology is that people believe they get what they pay for. And so the more you charge, the more people feel they're going to get what they pay for. I was working for 6 hours with a client in San Diego, and before I began, the president got up. He had his 32 top people in the room. And I was dealing with a software company, helping them move to value-based pricing. And he said, "What do you think Alan's charging to be here for 6 hours?" And I had just agreed to be there, but, you know, he had chosen a six-hour time frame. And somebody said $2,500, $3,500. Somebody said, "Does it include lunch?" And the president said, "He's charging me $18,500. You better listen up." What he was saying was that not only was there I'm completely wrong, but that he could afford me. Buyers have ego. I spoke the other day in North Carolina for 6 hours for $44,000. Buyers have ego. And so consultants kill themselves by underappreciating their value, and even when they appreciate their value, not having the chutzpah to state the right thing.
Well, and I think you mentioned the real key for me anyway a while back when you said it's all about results. And so if you get very clear on the results you're producing, I think that makes it easier to say, rather than I'm going to come in and work for $250 an hour, that if you're making somebody $100,000 through some change, well, then all of a sudden maybe that changes your feelings about what you should get.
But, John, you're exactly right. But and let's look at the tangible example. If somebody says, I am going to run a strategy retreat, and my strategy retreat for a day and a half or whatever it is $15,000, and they think they've gotten good money, I mean, the point is that a successful strategy retreat that creates a successful consensus strategy that enables people to penetrate a new market or change direction and save $40 million or create another $9 million in revenues, that's the way you look at this, as a process that's providing results. But as long as you look at it as a deliverable, you'll never make enough money.
The two of your books are Million Dollar Consulting and Million Dollar Consulting Toolkit. So I wondered if you would maybe, and the number's arbitrary, but share maybe 3, 4, 5 of your best tips in terms of how somebody builds a million-dollar consulting business.
Well, sure. Million Dollar Consulting is coming out in its fourth edition next year from McGraw-Hill. It's been on the shelf since 92, which is remarkable for a business book. And I'm running the Million Dollar Club in Nevis in November for people who are doing seven figures. And then I'm running something called 6 to 7, how to go from six figures to seven figures in Las Vegas and in Sydney, Australia. And Las Vegas is already sold out, and that's next March. So there's a lot of interest in this stuff. And here are 5 or 6 quick tips. Number one, this is a relationship business, period. And so it's not about cold calls. They don't work in this business. It's not about third-party sales and brokers and stupid things like that. It's about forging a relationship with real buyers. And that brings me to point two. It's a relationship, but with real buyers, people who can write a check for your value. Those people are virtually never, ever in human resources or in training or in organization development. There's a reason people are in human resources, and the reason is the organization doesn't want them anywhere else. And you might think that's harsh, but it's absolutely true. Human resources has deteriorated over the last 20 years. You want to deal with line executives of people who have profit centers or major staff areas. So you have to have a relationship with a buyer. Number three is you need to gain conceptual agreement with a buyer. And conceptual agreement means you're not talking about deliverables, you're not talking about time. What you're talking about is what are the objectives to be achieved? What are the business outcomes the buyer wants achieved? Number two, what metrics will tell you that you're making progress? And number three, what's it worth to the organization? If you have that, then you can provide a proposal. And a proposal is a 2.5-page, a brief document. You know, I've written books on this, how to write a proposal, that puts the conceptual agreement in front of the buyer. And the nuance here is that by the time the buyer sees the proposal, you already have agreement on the major points through this relationship you have. And so a proposal is a summary, not an exploration. It's not a negotiating document. It's simply a summary of conceptual agreement. And finally, you have to charge fees commensurate with the outcomes that you're generating. If you do that, you can easily make seven figures in this business. And I'll tell you something, you know, you're talking about million-dollar consulting. Somebody put out a book called Six Figure Consulting. Who on earth would write a book or read a book called Six Figure Consulting? You've got to think bigger than that. You know, nobody goes to the Olympics and says, let's go for the bronze. And the fact is, $100,000 is not what it used to be.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, I just took a trip across the Atlantic on the Queen Mary. My wife and I celebrated our 40th anniversary. We sailed on the Queen Mary 2 to London, to Southampton. The suite we were in, the largest on the ship, cost $5,000 less than my first house.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way of the world today. And so it's not about being pecuniary. It's not about being miserly. It's not about being, you know, avaricious. What it's about is understanding that to support a lifestyle that can send kids to a good school, put money away for retirement, contribute to charity, you know, be a philanthropist. To do these kinds of things, you have to increase your earning power.
One of the kind of interesting topics that I hear a lot of times, and this is where you really, if you're not charging enough, you're probably going to run into this often. But I often have people say, "Well, gosh, what do I do when I, you know, I end up working with a customer? I just can't please them. They won't do what I've asked them to do. We're not getting results." And so, you know, there comes a time when you probably should disengage with a client. And I know that you have spoken about this often. And so, you know, how and when do you do that?
Well, the beauty of having a signed proposal is that you have accountabilities and the client has accountabilities. And so if you find that the client is not meeting his or her accountabilities, you point it out immediately. And you say, for example, "Look, you said that you would get R&D involved in this. We can't do it without them, but you haven't done that yet." Or, "You said that you would personally stand up and announce this to the organization. You haven't done that yet." And so when you find that the client's not meeting his or her accountabilities, you stop working. My philosophy also includes the fact that you should be paid up front. So the leverage you have, and again, this is the problem for consultants, because they don't bill correctly. Not only don't they have the right fees, but their payment terms are lousy. And so there's this constant pressure on them, because to make the right decision, which is to chastise the client or to stop working, jeopardizes them because they haven't received much money yet. If you get paid properly, you can say to the client, "Look, either ship up or shape out. I'm stopping work until you do this."
Yeah.
But that's for the, it takes tough love sometimes, John.
Yeah, you know, people ask me sometimes, what's the biggest mistake you can make in coaching, consulting, and I personally believe that it's caring more about the results that you get for your customer than they do, and I think that's where sometimes people get hung up, and so they end up doing the work, or they end up compromising their fees or their work, and I think that that's how you really get yourself in some bad engagements.
But let me comment on what you just said, just two things quickly. The first is that consultants are too much in love with their methodology. Nobody cares what they do. I mean, nobody cares what a consultant does. What they care is what's in it for them. But if you look at consultants' websites, and if you look at consultants' promotional and collateral material, they're talking about their history, their belief system. Nobody cares. You know, what, do I care that you have the highest standard of ethics? Gee, I was looking for a consultant with low ethics, you know?
Right.
And so nobody cares about your methodology. That's the how. What people care about is what's in it for them. The second thing is, people talk about scope creep a lot, as though it's some mystical kind of thing. Oh, yeah, scope creep. Don't let the client slide things in. I found that the bigger problem is what I call scope seep. And scope seep occurs because the consultant keeps doing things the consultant shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
And that just erodes the hell out of the margins.
Yeah. No question. We are going to, I'm talking with Alan Weiss about Million Dollar Consulting, and we are going to move to some Q&A. So if you, we have a few of those that have come in. If you want to pose questions on the question and answer tab, now is definitely the time to do so. I've got up on the screen also a couple opportunities, and Alan, anybody spends any time on your site, it's really amazing, I think, the breadth of areas that you really do cover. You have, just for instance, a couple things coming up, a self-esteem workshop you talked about. You've got your million-dollar consulting college, and then you have what you call a private roster mentor program. You want to, I know I dumped a lot out there, but you want to just briefly touch on what those opportunities are?
Well, in 1992, million-dollar consulting came out, and people started calling me for consulting help, which I was giving them for free, and it became overwhelming. So in 96, I started to charge for it, and I thought that would drive people away. And instead, between then and now, I have a community of over 700 people who have entered my private roster mentor program. I mean, once you're in it forever, but there are various options within it. But it provides unlimited access to me, and we deal both strategically and tactically. Plus, you join this global community. For example, you get on Alan's Forums, which is a website that goes 24/7 with people all over the world, arguing and debating fees and ethics and marketing and all kinds of great things, even politics. So that's the mentor program. The Million Dollar Consulting College in November is the 11th one I'm running. I run them about twice a year. It's 4.5 days of highly intensive work at a gorgeous facility with very few people, less than 20 people. And we throw ourselves into every phase of the game, from creating your brand to marketing to fee setting. We do role plays. We talk about proper methodologies. We talk about how things like coaching and facilitating and training and speaking fit in. And you practice all this. It's the most intensive and probably most effective consultant coaching anywhere. I know of nothing else, you know, like that. So those are the kinds of things I try to do for the profession. I talked about 6 to 7, which is moving from 6 figures to 7. The self-esteem workshop is an attempt to take on this very key problem that consultants have, which is, how do they feel better about themselves? How can they look at a buyer as a peer? What is it that's weighing them down? What baggage are they carrying that prevents them from seeing the buyer as a peer and evaluating the buyer just as they're being evaluated? So those are the kinds of things I try to get people to move toward, that level of sophistication in the business.
We have a few questions coming in. I'd love to pose some of those to you. I think there's some great questions. I'm going to pick one that I find interesting here. It's based on a lot of what we're talking about, and it's rather lengthy, so hold on. One-on-one coaching, executive coaching, is very hard to measure. This is from Jonathan. Oftentimes, you don't know what the outcome goals are and what is achievable until after you start the process. So how do you put a price tag on that?
Well, I disagree totally with that premise.
Okay.
First of all, you have no right coaching anyone without having developmental objectives. In other words, you don't just become an executive coach. You don't just say, I'm going to coach you. You're coaching somebody for a purpose. And so there's some improvement purpose. And so if somebody says, I want to work with the media better, I want to work with financial figures better, I want to address the troops better, there's got to be something that's causing them to want you as their coach. That's number one. Number two, once you know what those things are, you say to the client, how would you know it if you tripped over it, which is Bob Mager's famous phrase. How would you know we're achieving these? Well, I'll receive less questions for clarification after my presentations. I'll look forward to dealing with the press more, and I'll proactively schedule press appearances. Whatever it is, the client tells you, here's how they measure it, and then you establish the value, and then your fee. It's no different. That's why I'm saying coaching and consulting are not different. One's a subset. But I'll tell everybody out there, and I'm not trying to chastise Jonathan here, but the fact is, nobody has a right to coach anyone else without knowing at the beginning, clearly, what the developmental objectives are and how you're going to know if you reach them.
Yeah, you're at risk of doing us both a disservice, aren't you? One of the things that I always love to add in there, too, and you touched on this, but is, what are the constraints, too? What's going to stop you from getting these results? Do you know what that looks like, or are these results unrealistic because you're not going to do X? I think sometimes getting that conversation on the table early is a good one as well.
It should go without saying, but in any coaching relationship, if you're worth your salt, you need rules of engagement.
Yeah.
And so we're not talking today in terms of coaching methodology, but you need rules of engagement so that both sides understand what's expected of them and what might get in the way and how to eliminate it or prevent it.
So, and maybe you alluded to this a little bit, but I think this is a great segue to another question with Todd, who says, well, what are some of the tips then for coming up with those measurable results that you're going to really give to a customer or prospect?
Well, first of all, the key thing you have to understand here is you don't give anything to the client. The client comes up with the objectives. What a consultant has to do is ask the right questions. And what I help to teach people to do, which makes life much simpler, but people don't seem to understand, is the consultant's job is to ask, not tell. The consultant's job is to be diagnostic, not prescriptive. Instead, so many consultants come in and say, well, it must be the buyer. What's wrong with you? You're damaged. I never assume my client's damaged. So you ask questions. What do you want to achieve? What is there that will make a difference in the future? And so forth. You have 5 or 6 questions. And you let the client tell you what the business outcomes are. You make an assessment whether they're duplicative or they're really different or whether they're reasonable or unreasonable. Then you say, fine, if your objective is to decrease attrition, which is, that's a legitimate objective, how would you know that was happening? And the client says, we bring on 1,400 new people a year. Right now we're losing 20%. That number would go down below 20%. Okay, how else would you know? We receive less complaints from new hires that they're not being oriented correctly or they don't know where the restroom is. I don't know. But those are measures. And then you say, if that's the objective and that's the measure, what's the value to you? And the client says, well, every new hire who we retain beyond 6 months and doesn't leave us saves us $45,000 because that's replacement cost. And that's how you go about this. But you get the answers from the client. You don't give the client the answers. The client's the one responsible for that.
Yeah, what I find, and those are the hard questions that you need to be asking, but I will say that one of the things I think trips people up is what they're really trying to do is get hired. And sometimes asking the hard questions delays getting hired.
Well, this goes back to two things I was talking about. One is self-esteem. They're afraid of rejection.
Yeah.
If you look at the psychological studies, interviewers are as afraid of rejection as the interviewee.
Huh.
It's ridiculous, but that's the case.
Yeah.
And so consultants are afraid of rejection because they have low self-esteem. But the second thing is, instead of trying to get hired, what you have to figure out is, how can I best help this person? Not how can they give me money, how can I help them? And consultants are overwhelmingly concerned about how they're going to get money. If they focused instead on how they can really provide value to the client, they'd actually make more money.
Absolutely. How about two more questions? Do you have time for that?
Well, I have time.
Time for two more questions.
I'm not going anywhere.
All right. Well, good. My clients, this is Buck, is asking, my clients have pigeonholed me as a document provider, you know, marketing, study, research, et cetera. Where do I start in order to break out of that and become more of a consultant?
That's a really good question. The first thing is separate his existing clients from new prospects, from new clients.
Right.
And you have to, so what's really happened is his clients haven't pigeonholed him. He has allowed himself to be pigeonholed. It's like when somebody says, gee, I'm intimidated, he intimidates me. No, you allow yourself to be intimidated. So you've allowed yourself to be pigeonholed. So every new prospect, every lead, everything you do with your collateral, with your website, with your conversation, should now talk about the results you generate as a consultant. Then, if some of these existing clients have high potential for the future, and only then, because you don't want to get bloody for nothing, go back to them and say, listen, I've entered into a new kind of working relationship with new clients. You've been such a great prior client that I'd be remiss if I didn't offer it to you as well. I now work on a value basis, and here are the advantages for you. And so that's what you do with high potential existing clients. But you have to reorient your own head and then go at it.
Absolutely great advice. The last question I want to pose to you is from somebody who's just trying to get started. You know, let's say you have a great service to offer, relatively new in the consulting business. How would you recommend marketing yourself until people begin to start calling you and passing your name around?
If the question is, how do I begin marketing if I'm brand new in the profession?
Yeah, I think that's basically the question, yes.
Here's the first thing you do. The very first thing you do is you call everyone you've ever known. And I mean family, friends, school graduates and colleagues, past employers, professional people like doctors, dentists, financial planners, designers. I mean everybody. You make an easel list of everybody you know, and you contact every single one, and you tell them two things. One, here is what I'm doing today, and you cite your value proposition. In other words, I'm helping organizations improve productivity. I'm helping organizations find new talent. I'm helping people decrease their stress levels. Whatever your value proposition is, you tell them, here's what I'm doing. And then the second thing you say is this. If this is of any help to you, please let me know, and I'll be happy to sit down and talk with you. And if you know of someone who can use this, I'd appreciate you putting us together. And then you follow up with that. And I guarantee if you get rid of your embarrassment and you get rid of your low self-esteem and you make a list of 60 people or 120 people, some people have had 300 people, you will get leads. And that's the great way to get started in this business, by going back to people who know you. Because what happens is you refer people to your dentist and your doctor and so on as a matter of courtesy, to your CPA. They have people who need what you do, but they don't refer people to you because they don't know what the hell you do.
Absolutely.
But you have to let everybody know what you're doing and ask for referrals. And one of the big crimes of consultants is they don't ask for referrals often enough.
You know, it's just basic marketing 101, networking, and probably good advice for any business, no matter what they do.
That's right. If you're an auto mechanic or you're a dentist or you're an insurance, that's exactly what you have to do. You have to develop the relationships from the area of least resistance, which are people you've already met.
Alan, thank you so much. Hopefully we can do this again sometime. I know you keep pretty busy and you're jetting around to various countries spreading your message, so hopefully we can do this again sometime. But
I'm happy to do it, John. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. And those of you on the call, our next session is actually October 6th, so that's going to come up pretty quick. Going to speak with Norm Brodsky and Bo Burlingham about their new book called The Knack. You probably bump into those folks every now and then out there on the speaking circuit. Both folks do a lot of writing for Inc. magazine. So once again, thanks everybody for joining me. This call will be archived and available within about 24 hours at Duct Tape Marketing. And again, Alan Weiss, Summit Consulting Group. Go check out all of the incredible things he's doing there and opportunities for you. Everybody take care.